Hello and welcome to The Green Room, where we discuss the latest happenings in cannabis. I'm Rhys Cohen, Editor-at-Large at Cannabis, and joining me today is Julian Wilches from Cleverleaves. Julian, welcome.
Hi, Rhys. Nice to meet you.
Nice to see you. So we're going to be doing a bit of a world tour today. I'm going to be picking Julian's brain about what's happening in various markets around the world, talk about some of the important trends that we're seeing and how they might relate to Australia, of course. But to start off, Julian, could you give us a bit of an overview about Cleverleaves, your company, you know, what you do, what you're up to, and what your role is in the organization, please?
Of course. So Cleverleaves is a company that we founded in 2016 in Colombia. In 2016, we received our first license for manufacturing cannabis products, basically, but then the regulation changed in Colombia. Only six companies obtained that license. So the process was a little bit delayed, but it started again in 2017. So we received all the licenses in Colombia. We built our capabilities. In Colombia, we have something around 18 hectares of medicinal cannabis greenhouses, our post-harvest and our laboratory, everything certified, the cultivation with GACP, the certification, and cultivation, post-harvest, and laboratory with European Union good manufacturing practices. What we produce over there is basically now dry flower, APIs, that means extracts, isolates, and finished and semi-finished products, bottle products. That's in Colombia. In Portugal, we built, because remember, Colombia just allowed the exportation of dry flower. So at that point, we were looking for an alternative. So we built an infrastructure in Portugal where we focus on dry flower. And then for distributing that product into a different market, especially in Germany. We have a distribution capability in Germany also. But then, and probably this is going to make sense later in our conversation, we have another asset in the US, non-related to cannabinoids, but it has access to more than 15,000 distribution points in the around the US. Walgreens, Walmart, GNC, CVS. So probably that dots will connect later in our conversation. That's us. So we produce APIs and finished products coming from cannabis with GMP standards. And right now we have been exporting to more than 15 countries in five continents, including Australia.
Including Australia. Thank you for that. Yeah. I'd love to touch on the almost uniquely cannabis phenomenon of companies having to set up completely different operations in different jurisdictions to service different markets because of how the regulations work. But to start off, I'm really interested in your personal professional background, if that's okay. You know, you have previously been the director of drug policy for the Ministry of Justice and Law in Colombia, and you also have a master's degree in both political science and journalism, as I understand it. What must that have been like for you? You know, experiencing the legalization of medicinal cannabis in Colombia in the context of, you know, what's been going on with drug laws, especially in Latin and South America for the last few decades.
Well, yeah, I've been working in narcotics or drug policy since 2003 through 2004, probably. So I worked for the presidential program against illicit crops, but we had a different approach to what was happening at that time. So it was not about fighting against something, but substituting that for a different alternative for creating new alternatives for farmers and people living in those very far away places in Colombia. So it was a very interesting approach because then I got to know the country where other people cannot go or could not go at that point. So I got the opportunity to have that sensibility from the people living in really poverty and far away from the cities. I made a career in the government as a consultant, and I was the drug policy director between 2011 and 2014. Two very important things happened during that period of time. One, Colombia, Guatemala, and Mexico proposed a special session of the United Nations General Assembly, UNGAS 2016. So I lived, I had some responsibility in Colombia's position. I was the drug policy director. And I was part of all that process of preparing the position from actually the bloc of LATAM and some countries in Europe. Very interesting process. But in addition to that, the peace dialogue with the guerrilla in Colombia, specifically in the part or the point related to drug policy. So as soon as that point of negotiation was public, I quit the government. I had enough bureaucracy for some time. So I quit government. I went to the Attorney General's office, which is not part of the executive branch, but of the judicial branch in Colombia. So unfortunately, I missed all the process of cannabis regulation in the government because I left in 2016 and the regulation in 2014, mid-2014. And the person that replaced me working in cannabis regulation in 2015, basically. And then we had a law in 2016 and then decrees. So my entire life in narcotics. When you asked about how was that change between drug policy and now being in private sector, for me it was very natural because when I was in the public sector, I was always promoting the human rights approach, a public health approach, availability, access of the patients for or accessibility for these products to patients. This is another way of doing that. And to be sincere, we have been doing a lot of public policy from the private sector working together with the government.
Hmm. Really interesting stuff. Thank you for that. Have you found most governments to be open to having those conversations? I mean, if we look around the world at what's going on with cannabis policy specifically, that most countries, I assume, are not interested in considering regulatory changes, whilst others appear to be quite motivated. And countries are going about it, or jurisdictions are going about it, very different ways as well. What's your impression of that overall?
My impression, Rhys, is that if you knock the door, at the end of the day, somebody is going to open the door. In Clever Leaves, we like to build long-term relationships. That means that we want to be an open book. We have to be very transparent. We want to be very honest with our stakeholders. That includes also the possibility of being in contradiction, but with the spirit of growing and building together. So I will say that governments are interested in getting more information, in knowing our experience. Sometimes it's not difficult because then we have to knock the door for a long time. But at the end of the day, if you demonstrate that you're here to stay, to build a long-term relationship, that you have all the capabilities, that you can support the local processes in each country, that you have enough evidence or arguments to support your position, I think at the end of the day, they're going to open the door. Mm-hmm. Some countries first, some countries later, but yeah.
Yeah, as is always the case. Speaking of evidence, there are, you know, several, many things that jurisdictions need to consider when they're looking at how to change cannabis regulations, if they are going to. One of those things is evidence about, I assume, you know, medical efficacy, but also about how a new cannabis framework might interact with public health more broadly. What are some of the other, like, key things that, in your experience, governments really prioritize when they're thinking about changing regulations?
This is a very interesting question because we have like a very interesting equation in medicinal cannabis for patients. And that's the equation, medicinal cannabis for patients. So when talking about medicines, the key concept is quality, safety and efficacy, quality in the production. So that's one thing that should be considered. Then medicinal cannabis. Cannabis is nothing but a controlled substance, a narcotic, according to the single convention. So regulations consider that, and the key concept over there is traceability. If you understand traceability as who has the substance, where, how much, what for, then you understand that that's the four or five questions that every regulation answers. That's what you have to look for in each regulation. Countries manage these four questions and the four answers in a very different way. And the balance between that and the third key concept, which is patients or access, is what determines if the regulation is good or bad, I will say. So if you guarantee that the production is safe, manages quality standards, that is that you have a good traceability, but also you have you guarantee access for patients, then you have a good regulation. And let me give you an example. You can require a GMP full traceability and a full marketing authorization. So evidence is in process. So the whole industry is building the evidence. So who's losing in that equation? The patient, because it is going to take time to register a product. But if you create a special access scheme where you have quality and traceability, but you allow for the patients to access the medicine or the product, the medicinal products, with quality and traceability, but not necessarily a marketing authorization, then who's winning in that equation? The patient. That's why I like Australian regulation.
Great. Well, that's very flattering of you to say. Thank you. No, I'm not responsible for it, obviously. I'd like to talk about Australia specifically in a little bit. Talking about those three themes of quality, traceability, and access, do you see any inherent trade-offs between those? I mean, for example, a situation where quality and traceability are assured and access is facilitated appropriately or for the benefit of patients, but without needing marketing authorization, without requiring companies to conduct the very expensive, very long-term clinical research that drugs would normally go through. Is there a long-term trade-off in terms of companies lacking the incentive to conduct that kind of medical scientific research, do you think?
I cannot speak in the name of patients, let's say, but what I can tell you in our experience is that we're talking about one country, Australia. That's the case in Australia. Let's say we have a very similar case in Brazil, I will say. We have a special access scheme, which includes that after 5 years of your temporary registration, you have to have evidence. That's one. In Germany, for example, you can have magistral preparations until somebody registers a similar product. So then you will have you have to pursue a marketing authorization at that point. And that's the case almost in every jurisdiction. So at the end, look, this is very interesting. 5 years ago, probably having a license was of the essence. But that was very valuable in this industry. 2 or 3 years, scale. You know, like today, quality certifications and clients, sales. You know? But in 4 or 5 years, it is going to be R&D, basically, new developments. And who has a marketing authorization? So the industry as a whole, I think, should be moving towards the way the regular pharma industry works. It's going to take time. It's costly, but I think that's the way it's going to move.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, it's that's a really interesting analysis of the historical sort of changes for the industry. I like that a lot. Well, where does the United States fit into that? In all of this?
that's an interesting question. And it's an open question. I can tell you what we're doing. So as I mentioned, we have an operation in the US, not related to cannabinoids, with distribution around the country, more than 15,000 distribution points. So we're getting ready, but nobody knows what is going to happen. But the global trend is to regulate medicinal cannabis. When Colombia allowed for medicinal cannabis in 2016, probably 4 or 5 countries in the world allowed for medicinal cannabis. Today, more than 40, being United States, like a little bit a beautiful Frankenstein, because it has different regulations in different states. So at some point, FDA, DEA, the Congress, somebody is going to take some decisions in order to normalize that situation. And also probably with the interest not only of protecting the patient, guaranteeing traceability, guaranteeing access, but also guaranteeing international trade.
Right, because the U.S. is still locked out of the international cannabis markets to a large extent, right?
Yeah, some imports not related to the pharmaceutical industry, or some of them, but most of them to hemp. Regarding hemp, or as we're doing, partnering with companies that have all the DEA licenses, all the permits in order to import products. Remember that probably 1 month ago or a couple of weeks ago, we imported 30 kilograms of flour from Portugal to the US that we sold to BRC, which is a licensed company in the US.
A license for sale to consumers or to patients?
Yeah, they're licensed for manufacturing and distributing cannabis for different purposes. I mean, they have a license for managing the substance. Uh-huh. So the final use depends on who has the different permits.
Hmm. Fascinating. Wow. I was not aware of that. That's a really interesting development. Hmm. Curious. And And talking about the sort of long-term path of the industry, you mentioned moving towards drug registration, marketing authorization, that kind of thing. Which countries do you see facilitating that the best? I know you mentioned Brazil provides that really time-limited incentive for companies to get their act together. But are there other countries around the world that are better or worse for conducting the human clinical research needed to pursue marketing authorization, do you think?
Yeah, I think Brazil, Portugal, Israel is doing a lot of R&D. We personally think that the US is a very... Or as personally think that the US is a very interesting country, because when something happens in the US, then it's going to be replicated in many places. Mm. And actually, that's why we launched this project, Project Change Lives, which is willing to give up to $25 million in product to researchers and institutions, universities. We already partnered with 2 or 3 of them for conducting different studies. And we want to support, I mean, as I mentioned, the future of this industry is in R&D. And if we isolate ourselves from the research community, then it's going to be very expensive. It's going to take time. But if we partner with the research community and the universities and people that has been doing this for years, and we provide a GMP product that is standardized, that it's traceable, and that has quality, and then I think it's a perfect match. That's the purpose at the end of the day of Project Change Lives, like boosting the research and development and facilitate that those processes in the US.
Yeah, it's a really interesting campaign, Project Change Lives. What's been your experience of working with those research institutions and universities? Compared to working with private sector companies, I assume there are some cultural differences perhaps, or in my experience in Australia anyway, universities in particular tend to take a long time to do things and have particular requirements. Has that been your experience also? Or
No, not necessarily. Probably the most important thing is like to have obviously the institutional support, but also have a real champion inside those institutions, promoting the research in the university or research center. What we have found is that they were expecting to have additional products. That in the US, you have two sources for research and development. One is the University of Mississippi, but then you need and the other source is the local source, which is probably legally in the state or legal in the state. But if you want to have a project approved by the FDA, then that will not work. So researchers were willing to have a broader portfolio, GMP certified, with a reliable supply chain. So I don't think it's too hard to open the doors at the universities.
Yeah, interesting. Speaking about the rapid increase in the number of countries around the world that have legalized medicinal cannabis, I mean, I think Australia was one of those handful back in 2016. But now you say, 30, 40 countries maybe. What are the largest markets at the moment that you think are the most interesting? And what are some of the markets that you have an eye on for a few years down the track?
Right now, I think we have four very interesting markets: Germany, Brazil, Israel, and Australia. Rapid increase in imports, in sales, in patients. So I think everybody's looking at those four countries. And what's coming next is, I will say, Europe as a very interesting place. We keep an eye on Spain, Italy, Poland, France, of course, with its pilot project. UK, which is like a mm-hmm. big quotation mark, like interrogation mark. Mm-hmm. But definitely Europe. And again, what we keep an eye on the US very closely, because it's the biggest market, but it's very enclosed in each state.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. And then across those sort of large markets, Brazil, Israel, Germany and Australia, are you seeing similar trends or different trends in terms of where the regulations are heading or where patient preferences or prescriber preferences are heading, or are countries going about things in very different ways?
Yeah, no, different trends. For example, flower is a the dominant category in Israel, I guess up to 90% probably in Israel, or I will say extracts will be the oils, let's say, will be 10 to 15%. While for example, in Brazil, flower is not allowed. So the trend is 100% in oils. So very opposite trends in Israel and Brazil. In Australia, we're seeing a very interesting trend of oils increasing, or we have more calls each time for oils in Australia, and also in Germany. Actually, flour seems to be stable, while oils are increasing. I mean, stable not increasing as the oils. Let's say
stable relative to the other product category. But still growing.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm. Exactly. Still growing. Each queue.
Yeah. Yep. That's it. Upwards. And are there any sort of major barriers to those markets at the moment that would prevent them from continuing to grow? Or
I can tell you from the manufacturer side, at least. You have to comply with the different stringent regulations. So in Australia, we have to comply with TGO 93. In Israel, we have to comply with the 260 plus list of pesticides that you have to test. in Germany, you have to comply with the DAB, which is the German monograph, which is a different requirement than for Portugal, for example. And for Brazil, then you have to comply with the 327, the specific local regulation. So totally different worlds, but at the end of the day, it's you have to satisfy and comply all the local regulations, in addition to comply the local regulation where you manufacture the product. That's why it's very interesting. Colombia just, President Duque signed a new decree in July, actually at the cultivation, at our cultivation site in Clary Leaves in July. And in the process of negotiating this decree, they were asking, how can Colombia increase the quality requirements for exportation? And I think there was an agreement in the industry saying, please guarantee traceability, because quality is going to be guaranteed by the importing country. You know, like, and we obviously we spoke about the pesticides in Israel, the TGO-93 in Australia, which, by the way, in some cases is more rigorous or more stringent than the European pharmacopoeia, for example. Importing countries are very, very strict in terms of required quality requirements.
That's really interesting for a country that, like Colombia, that is primarily focused on exports and global markets, to consider regulations like, you know, to focus on traceability locally, on the understanding that destination countries will mandate quality standards as they see fit. But obviously there must be local quality standards as well for the local patients in Colombia, I assume.
Yeah, I think that was very smart from the Colombian regulators. In addition to that, how in that equation, how do Colombia protect the patient and is applying the standards for magistral preparations that it has to comply with the standard of a magistral preparation, phytotherapeutic product, or synthetic medicine, as for the, all the other medicines or magistral preparations or phytotherapeutics coming from other products.
Really interesting. Let's move on to Australia. You mentioned TGO-93 can be a very stringent quality standard. Companies don't have to prove that they comply with TGO-93 before successfully exporting to Australia, only declare that they comply and hope that any gaps don't get picked up by post-market surveillance. Is that a model that you think is appropriate, or, you know, do you have any concerns about that?
That's why there's a discussion in Australia regarding the fact that local manufacturers are requested to have the GMP certification. But that's not the case of the manufacturers outside Australia. And probably you can illustrate us, that's a local debate, which I find very interesting and fair, I will say. Mm. I can tell you, Riz, that if the requirement is A, the product that we're shipping is A. We don't take it this like as a joke. We're not cowboys. I mean, we are a GMP certified company. So if the requirement says less than one, what we're sending is less than one. Obviously tested with validated methods or in a third party lab, also validated in our quality system. So we take this very seriously. I will say that time will tell if companies start to not comply with local regulations, then regulations are going to get more stringent.
I hope so. Yeah. And in terms of access in Australia, you mentioned you're a big fan of our special access scheme, which, you know, allows access to medicines that haven't been registered or that don't have marketing authorization. What are some other aspects of the Australian sort of patient access framework that you like or dislike, or have any thoughts on, or any particular trends that you've been observing?
No, I will just highlight again two things. One, and is that regulation in Australia cares about quality, cares about traceability, and offers an alternative path for accessing the medicinal product. Mm-hmm. Now we'll see what happens with list three products, category three products in Australia. It's very interesting OTC, but then you have to prove safety and efficacy, which is something that, I mean, it's natural. You have to prove, if you're going to sell something to a human, then you will have to prove that that's not going to hurt that person. So we'll see how it works. Very interesting category also. Let's see how it works. It's very early. When we discuss with friends or with you, for example, the trends, the history, we can only refer to a history of 5 years. So this is this is an industry in the very early stages. Conclude things at this point is just probably guessing a little bit. What we try to do is to take decisions after analyzing the situation, analyzing our capability of complying or not, of having a reliable production system, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And when we find the right to win, then we commit. That's why we built our GMP facility as a GMP facility since day one. We designed it and built it in less than a year. That takes a lot more time in other countries of the world. And that's the way it works. So we decide and then we execute it in a fast way or as fast as we can in order to satisfy the demand and our clients.
Yeah. It is a good exercise to remind yourself how little time has passed since legalization. it's a good sanity check sometimes. Yeah.
Yes, I agree.
But speaking of finger in the air, fortune telling, Clever Leaves is a country that has cultivation facilities in low cost areas like Colombia and Portugal, comparatively to say Australia, and you are competing with companies that have to build and operate in Australia, which has some different cost structures, it would be fair to say. What do you think about the long-term opportunities for companies that are cultivating and manufacturing in export destination markets as opposed to origin markets like Colombia? Is it viable?
Let me see if I understand the question. If I understood the question. So what's the future of the companies that are producing in our destination markets? Mm. So let's say in Germany, in Australia, in Israel, right? Mm. Again, this industry is, I think this industry is growing as a global industry. So you have imports in Australia from Canada, from the Netherlands, I will say, I'm not sure, from Colombia, from Uruguay to Australia. And that's very interesting because probably the international trade between these countries is not very common, I will say, with some of them, not between Colombia and Australia, I will say. But then this is growing as a global industry. Mm. So in a global economy, probably what is going to happen is that manufacturing is going to go to countries with the right to win, with the advantages that we have in Colombia or in Portugal, where we have greenhouses, instead of simulating all the conditions that we naturally have in Colombia, for example. So manufacturing sites probably will move to countries. A couple of weeks ago, I was part of a panel in Toronto, and the panel was about Latin America. And we were discussing, not a lot of people were aware about Latin America. was it, the event was most likely or mostly about the US and Canada. And the panel went very well because it was very interesting to show that while in Canada, they have the good production practices as a standard, but they don't allow for imports. And in the US, they don't have quality standards in the federal level. In LATAM, we're building, or particularly in Colombia, we're building a production site with all the compliant with all the requirements of a global industry. So probably once the US or Canada approves the or requires for a GMP certification, who's going to be in a better position for satisfying those products? The ones that are getting ready right now, as we're doing. Probably the local producers in the US are going to take time for getting the GMP certification. Same in Canada, where only just a few companies received that GMP certification. So we feel that we have a good strategy, Reese.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting few years, that's for sure. Just a couple more questions, if I can impose on you. We've spoken a lot about medicinal cannabis, and there are unique challenges with producing, distributing, accessing that. I'm also interested in your opinions about recreational cannabis in the context of international commerce and trade. At the moment, obviously, it's not possible. What do you think would need to happen for that to change, for two countries with recreationally legal markets to export products to each other internationally?
So we know what the single convention says, which is basically that international trade of a controlled substance can only be done for medicinal or research purposes. That's basically what the single convention says. International trade for other purposes is something that different people actually started in the past. There are a couple of options from the international trade perspective and international relationships. But in any case, what will be required is political will. And until some big countries do not agree to have like an international trade of a controlled substance for different purposes, I think it's going to be more kind of isolated countries producing and as is the case of Uruguay and Canada, you know, the isolated production and internal consumption. But at least for a couple of years.
Yeah, for a long time, I think, possibly. Yeah. and finally, you know, if you have any final sort of thoughts or advice on to Australia on, you know, regulatory changes or market trends to watch out for over the next few years, what would be the big things that you think we should be paying attention to going forward?
To be honest, it's not regulatory related. It's health related, which means I hope the this pandemic goes well in Australia, so Australia can open again to the world. Because we need to have this relationship between different countries flowing. So we want our clients to visit our production sites, to know us, to get to review in person all the documentation, the infrastructure, and then we're also willing to go to Australia to meet in person with TGA, with you guys, with our clients. So that's my hope for Australia.
Yeah, mine too. Well, hopefully it won't be long now, actually. And we'll look forward to having you when it does come time. Well, Julian, thanks so much for chatting with me. It's been really a fascinating conversation. I appreciate you taking the time. And hopefully we'll see you at an Australian event next year, maybe.
Hopefully. I would love to. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Reese.